It is 8:09 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy, time now for one of my absolute favorite guests, Professor David Schultz of Hamline University. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. How about you this evening?
Pretty good, pretty good. I did not mean to hang up on you just moments ago. Kevin had to call you back. I apologize.
Don't worry about it.
Not intended.
I know. Okay. I'm not offended. I think it's happened a couple of times.
Yes, it is. I'm just a klutz when it comes to the fancy technology we have here in our studios.
Most people probably haven't seen all the technology in that room, and it's right. And I've been there, and you've got like buttons and switches and stuff everywhere.
Right, which is why I should not be put anywhere near them, and why Kevin keeps us on the air. Anyway, a lot going on this week. Certainly, the dominant news story engendering a lot of debate, discussion, certainly hand-wringing, the tragedy in Las Vegas. Your thoughts about that and the fact that there are actually some Republicans now actually saying we should take a look at these bump stocks.
Well, a couple of different things here. First is the fact that until the NRA came out midweek and said it'd be willing to support some kind of legislation on bump stocks, it looked like that this was going to be another shooting where nothing really was going to change in terms of the debate around guns in our society. And I still think that it's a long shot that anything will actually take place in terms of any meaningful legislation, but this understand for many people why, for many people might understand why the debate is so frozen the way it is. You know, and one of them is about the fact that we've got the NRA, which is a dominant player in sort of this area of policy in terms of gun regulation, and it has taken the position for many, many years that any compromise whatsoever is against their ideology because they're afraid of the slippery slope. And so you link that with a dominant position, no compromise, and how at the same time guns are protected under the Second Amendment, and throw into that that in many parts of the country, guns are part of a cultural identity, and what we've produced as a Republican and Democratic parties that are just polarized on this like so many other issues, and there seems to be no ground to move on anything.
Is it at all significant, though, that the NRA is saying, let's take a look at this in terms of these bump stocks?
It is. It is in the sense that there may be legislation that actually can get through Congress and signed by the president that would outlaw them. But I'm going to argue that this is just brilliant politics by the National Rifle Association, because in many ways the bump stocks look like they're being very reasonable. It looks like we're doing something in terms of gun control. But at the end of the day, it's really not going to have a major impact in terms of guns or gun violence in the United States, because what those stocks do is to basically convert some weapons into semi-automatic, perhaps automatic weapons. And given the fact that it's legal to purchase those type of weapons, what happens here is that it really doesn't change the availability of guns. It doesn't, go after some of those assault type of weapons. It really doesn't do anything. In fact, it's smart business. Those bump stocks are between $100 and $200. They actually undercut the price of actually having to buy an automatic or semi-automatic, weapon. So I think NRA can say, yep, we're going to be reasonable. We're going to support these stocks. We're going to eliminate them, but it's not going to have really much impact in terms of changing the overall gun debate or making us dramatically safer, even marginally safer in our society.
In terms of the discussion there, and certainly President Trump said, he didn't shut the door. In some ways, he appeared to almost open it, saying it's not the time to do it, which I think is in the aftermath of something like this, the immediate aftermath, that does make sense. In the past, he has indicated support for gun control measures.
Yes.
Then during his campaign, he was absolutely not. And now, I mean, what do you make of this? And is this something where the unpredictable president could be unpredictable once again?
Well, he could be unpredictable again. And it all depends on which direction he wants to go on this issue. If he's still looking at being or trying to shore up his base that he can't move on this issue. If he's thinking in terms of wanting to pick up swing voters, wanting to move more to the center, wanting to be able to maybe broker something with Democrats in terms of getting a legislative victory, then he goes in that direction. And that still becomes the great mystery here, because it's still not clear where Trump is, you know, after almost 10 months of his presidency. Again, no major legislative victories. Yes, some minor ones, some executive orders, but certainly nothing significant. And I just don't see any overarching sort of ideology or guidance here in terms of what he's trying to do. But it seems like every time he's talked about wanting to, let's say, negotiate with the Democrats or to do something along that line, he comes back and then undercuts it. I remember a few weeks ago, there was talk about him carving a deal with DACA. You know, I was talking to my students on Friday about this, and they said, well, what's happened with that? And I said, I'll be darned if I know at all what's happened on
right.
that.
Right, and that's, we actually had started off the show with an immigration attorney who says it's just utter confusion for so many people, because it's not, you know, yes, he said he was open to the deal, but unless Congress acts by March, he said it's essentially dead.
Right, and nobody seems to be pushing it. And so even after he announces that, then, you know, he basically takes other types of statements or actions that seem to pull back from that as he starts to go back and talk to his base. And so this may be the same thing here, is that on the one hand, he is talking perhaps to a broader audience after the shooting, but then, you know, might come back and either do nothing or now undercut that or oppose it, you know, somewhere down the line. So while I think everybody's getting excited about the idea that something could happen, you know, I'm still skeptical, and then again, equally skeptical that the type of regulation that's being talked about here will really solve anything. But this takes me to a broader sort of statement here, is that on one level, what I've seen going on for the last few years between the Democrats and Republicans after a shooting is probably more sloganeering and less, I think, real policy. Because, you know, as I teach in one of my public policy classes, you know, we have sort of a two-stage process here. You know, if we decide we actually want to do something, we have to define what the problem is and then craft the solutions. And I'm not sure anybody really understands or is clear regarding what is the gun problem. In fact, I think it's multiple problems. It's availability of guns. It's the regulation. It's the fact that we have
certainly mental health.
We have some mental health issues there. We've got domestic abuse issues out there. We've got chemical abuse issues. We've got a myriad of things out here, and there's no one silver bullet out there in terms of trying to solve things. And I know for some of my friends who are saying, well, why can't we just sort of ban all the guns? And I talked a little bit about this in my blog today, where I said if they tried to pull, if even if you could pull off that ban, and again, there's a Second Amendment issue about why you can't do that, I think prohibition will look like child's play compared to what we would see if we tried to ban guns in our society.
Well,
today.
Yeah, absolutely. That would not work. It's just the question of, and you wonder what, there's so much of this out there,
yeah.
You know, even if you did take some steps, I mean, it's just when you look at what happened on Sunday, you had or Saturday night into Sunday. I mean, you had Sunday night into Monday. You had a madman. I mean, for all the precautions that were taken, shooting from basically the air.
You're right, right. And think about it. What if we? And again, one of the calls out there is for universal background checks. You know.
So this guy had nothing.
He had nothing. He neither had a history of mental illness, nor did he have a history, any kind of criminal history, and therefore he would have, you know, gone straight through this. Plus, again, I still want to come back and make the point and say that, you know, we have approximately 43 million people in the United States who are diagnosed with some form of mental illness. I don't think all 43 million are dangerous, So to say that we're going to prevent people with mental illnesses from buying guns is probably overly broad in terms of the people who have mental illnesses who shouldn't have guns. And at the same time, there's so many people who don't have histories or diagnosed of histories that are probably violent, that the background checks, again, will only solve a small little piece.
Right. Well, it's a devastating situation. Obviously, so many things up in the air with that. The president, though, kind of signaling that he might be willing and open to something. The president also signaling that could be ready to work with Democrats on a fix for Obamacare. Let's take a quick break, and we'll get Professor Schultz's take on that after this. It is 8:22 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy, along with Professor David Schultz, talking politics. What do you make of President Trump announcing to everyone that he has reached out to Senator Charles Schumer, the minority leader in the Senate, talking about a possible deal on a fix for Obamacare? Is this a plan? Is this a proposal? Is this a threat to Republicans? I mean, what's going on here?
It might be a little bit of everything you just described there, and it also still might be a pipe dream again. And again, we just don't know, because, again, before break, we talked a little bit about how several weeks ago it looked like the Democrats, including Pelosi, Schumer, and Trump, had worked out a deal on DACA, and that's really not going anywhere right now. I'm not seeing any legislation being moved. I didn't see how it changed the politics of that issue whatsoever. And it's the same thing here I'm looking at in terms of the fact that clearly, again, Trump does want a legislative victory, and at one level he's talking about wanting to do this deal, you know, with the Democrats to maybe, you know, fix something with the Affordable Care Act. But at the same time, he's also cut back on just about 90% of the advertising and funding, you know, for the re-enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act. So at the same time, he's pursuing two different strategies, one that appears to be trying to undercut it, the other that appears to be trying to fix it. And so, again, it becomes difficult in terms of trying to figure out, is there any kind of broader strategy here, or is it just sort of, you know, him sort of, I don't want to say quite say sort of, you know, drifting in the dark on this stuff? It's really hard to figure it out.
And you know, the thing, though, is that there's still so much uncertainty here, because the president, it's the mixed signals, and in terms of, you know, MinCare,
yeah,
which provides, you know, health care for 160,000, right? It's over 100,000 people here,
right?
Low-income people. It's not clear what Minnesota's going to get.
That's exactly correct. And I think that's the other complication here. It's not just the mixed messages in terms of is Trump reaching out to the Democrats to work on something, the Affordable Care Act. We've got a lot of other things going on here, which we did an interview on the story a couple of weeks ago, which is about whether or not Minnesota is going to get the waivers that it needs to be able to run its health care programs.
Well, it did get the waiver.
It got the waivers on that, but then it's also about the money that's going to be necessary to do some of this in terms of some of the programs that we're offering, because there's some federal money that comes in with this too. And so there's a variety of uncertainties, or uncertainties, I'm not sure which the word it is, that we see in Minnesota and across the country on the whole issue of health care.
And the decisions, though, have got to come at some point.
Well, they do, because the enrollment periods, you know, are upon us now, and people have to be making these decisions pretty quickly. And at the same time, the state of Minnesota will need to figure out how it wants to fund some of these things going forward.
Right. There's a story that just came out in the New York Times about how we may be in the midst of really a fundamental realignment,
yes,
of the political parties. And certainly the person who gets the credit for, you know, capitalizing on that is none other than President Trump, who was savvy enough to figure out a different path towards the presidency in terms of, you know, being an unconventional candidate and appealing to those people who may have voted for other parties, you know, may have voted Democratic in years past. Do you think that is what is actually happening?
We are on the verge of that, yes. And this is something that if you look at the statistics, there are several different, and look at some trends, there are several things that are going on in the United States. One of them is really sort of a generational shift, where we're looking at what was called the silent generation, those born between 25 and 1945, who are up nicely, I will say, who are exiting out of the political system. The baby boomers are getting old and starting to age out too, and the millennials are taking over, and that's one driver of a sort of change. Also, what we're seeing is, with that generational shift, different attitudes on political ideology, views towards the party, views towards a lot of policy issues. And so we're seeing that combined with shifts in the economy and shifts with technology, all driving, I think, some pretty powerful changes, you know, in terms of our politics. And just to do a really couple of simple ones here, I mean, if we were to look at, let's say, even a year or so ago, and look and ask public opinion questions regarding attitudes about marijuana, GLBTQ issues, issues regarding immigration and so forth, that those who are under the age of 30 have dramatically different views in percentages compared to people who are over the age of 30 or certainly who are over the age of 60. And so as one cohort is being replaced and another is sort of supplanting it, that is driving tremendous changes. And within the Democratic Party, the battle between Clinton and Sanders was one indication of that, and then Trump as the anti-establishment, anti-Republican establishment candidate symbolized that in another way. So the answer is yes. When I saw the New York Times piece today, I said, yeah, there's an incredible amount of data that we can show about this restructuring. And in fact, there are some political scientists who argue that about every 30 or so years, we undergo significant restructurings of our political system. And the last time we had a major shift was really in the 1980s with Ronald Reagan. And people thought that Obama was going to bring about a shift. And it was kind of a partial shift. But we're still in the midst of it. In the next 5 to 10 years, our political system is different than it does right now.
Right. And certainly, you know, President Trump, you know, hearkening back to a new populism. And I think that that's something that I think people are beginning to look at. And clearly he is open, at least he has indicated verbally he's open to doing things in a different way.
Well, he is, and he's clearly responding to a populism, but it may be a populism that ages out. And I say that because think about it just in the last couple of days in terms of some of his executive orders, in terms of women's birth control and so forth, that these, again, represent one generation but don't necessarily represent an emerging generation of people who are coming up. And so I think you're seeing some short-term policy responses by Trump that represent one aspect of a political alignment, but longer term, the political alignments probably favor many policies that are very, very different than what Trump and his constituents are supporting.
All right. The one and only Professor David Schultz, and please do check out his blog, Schultz's Take. We do have to take a break. Then we're going to give you some weather. We'll have more with David Schultz after this. You are listening to News Radio 830 WCCO.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
It is 8:35. Esme Murphy, along with Professor David Schultz, talking about politics this evening. Want to ask you your thoughts. We've talked about the gun control issue, certainly, on the national level and in the aftermath of this horrible shooting in Las Vegas. One interesting development we saw here is that Congressman Tim Walz, who had previously had in past years an A rating from the NRA, actually donated his NRA donations, donated them to a veterans group. What do you make of that?
Well,
he is obviously one of the leading candidates for the DFL nomination for governor.
Yeah, I was going to say right now he's probably the front runner for the DFL, where it seems to be lots of people are coalescing around him. But a couple of things. One, first be non-skeptical. The non-skeptical is to say that out of principle he did what he did because he believed in it. And I know sometimes we forget about the fact that maybe politicians actually believe in what they're doing and actually genuinely care. And I would sort of say that might be the first answer. The second answer becomes sort of is it calculated? You know, is it calculated in the sense of how does it better posture himself in terms of running for governor? And so And it does. It certainly helps him because I think he, on the one hand, he has always been supportive of veterans' issues. But two, I think this gets him good press with veterans and many groups.
And he is himself obviously an ex-Marine.
Of course it is. And so that's why I'm saying is that I start with a premise that this may be a genuine belief that he has here, and we shouldn't read anything into it politically. But if we are to read something into politically, it probably helps him with some key constituencies in terms of solidifying bonds or solidifying support with him in some of these veteran groups and perhaps others who will be critical to his gubernatorial bid.
Is he, and certainly he made a splash as well this week by announcing, you know, very early on, I mean, the election is still, well, I guess it's 13 months away, that in the nominating convention, the primary, when would the primary be? Would that still be August. In August?
Okay. It's still in August, but we shouldn't forget the fact that the caucuses are February or March.
Right. But, he announced that his running mate would be Peggy Flanagan, who is a very progressive state representative from the western suburbs of Minneapolis. She is far more progressive than he is.
Yes.
Is this a reflection that he may be concerned that he is too conservative to get the nomination or win the primary?
Well, first off, I think the fact that the Democrats are continuing the pattern, as well as the Republicans, of having a male at the head of the ticket and a female as lieutenant governor. And one can raise all kinds of interesting questions about why we still have not yet nominated a woman or had a certainly nominated a woman as a Democrat or Republican to be a gubernatorial candidate in this state. And so
you do have Rebecca Otto running.
We do have
a number of other.
That's right, and we did have a few years ago Kelleher Anderson, you know, who got the convention.
She lost in the primary to Mark Dayton, but yeah, she was the nominee.
Yeah, to a guy named I think Dayton, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Yes, but the point is that we have yet to see coming into the general election a woman, you know, at the head of the ticket for governor for Democrat or Republican. But Flanagan, so is that sort of gender balance that we're seeing too. I think you hit at something very important here, is the fact that Tim Walz, I think, has a it appeals more to sort of outstate Minnesota, out to some of the more conservative aspects of the Democratic Party and swing voters. And I think he was concerned about how well he could sort of nail down and get the enthusiasm of the urban liberals. And Flanagan, I think, does that because, again, she's very progressive and very, very popular. In fact, you might recall she was even rumored to run for Keith Ellison's seat if he had actually gotten the head of the DNC, and when it was talked that he was going to resign. So she is very, very popular. Many Democrats like her. And I think it's also interesting that she's coming from the western suburbs. Now, I just want to double check here and be sure. Is she in Eric Paulson's district?
No, she is in Keith Ellison's district.
Keith Ellison. Okay, that's right. She is. That's right. I guess that's right. I should have realized because I just said she was going to run for Ellison's. Because I was going to say is that the western suburbs, though.
I mean, it may bleed over. I'm not 100, but she's definitely.
Yeah, she was.
Most of her district is definitely in Keith Ellison's.
That's right. That's right. I was going to say because even though you don't have to be live in the district where you're running,
it helps.
Yes, it does help. It helps a lot. But anyhow, in the western suburbs, this may help her quite. May help also because the western suburbs has a lot of votes, we know that, and shoring up his nomination with her, I think, is going to help going into the caucuses in the next several months because he's going to be able to build up delegates. Because even though you're right, we're 13 months away from general election, probably what 10 months away from the from a primary. We're only a few months away, you know, maybe 5 months away from the caucuses, and people are already making the phone calls and trying to get the delegates lined up. And so I think this is a very smart move, moving early and trying to nail down the nomination and support as quickly as possible.
Right, and you do have, there are actually, you know, a number of women running on the DFL side. Rebecca Otto, of course, Representative Erin Murphy, Tina Liebling. So there's some pretty strong female candidates out there. I think a lot of people seem to, when people talk about a front runner, I think a lot of people, including and you just did it, is look at Tim Walz as somebody who has the chops and might be well be considered a front runner at this point.
Right, right. And my comment before wasn't to disparage the women who are running this time around. What it was basically to say is that it's just interesting that we still have yet to see with either the Democratic or Republican Party a woman emerge as the general election candidate for governor in the state.
Right. One thing too, you know, looming over the Republican field, and he hasn't just, you know, he said he's not interested, but his name keeps popping up, is Tim Pawlenty.
Yeah, and I'm skeptical about that because, I mean, there's a little bit of a, you know, sort of been there, done that. You know, he's run and successfully, you know, ran twice and was governor. He's moved on to a very lucrative job, and I would find it hard pressed for him to come back. And plus, on top of which, I think the Republican Party that Tim Pawlenty was governor over several years ago is a very different Republican Party now, and I don't think he's a foregone conclusion that he would get the nomination, because I think the party is in many ways more conservative than he is, or even when he left on the governorship, you know, seven years ago.
Chatting here with Professor David Schultz on politics. 2018 is going to be a really interesting year, though, because of all these congressional races. Certainly with Tim Walz running for governor, that opens up that first congressional district, which is that may be the ultimate, you know, swing district, because that has gone back and forth historically. You've also got the second congressional district, which actually is rated by some of the trackers as a toss-up,
right.
And it's a rematch of Angie Craig and the incumbent congressman who just won, Jason Lewis. What do you think about that race? And in rematches, you did have a third-party candidate who actually polled in at 7% in that race that really theoretically could have tipped the balance perhaps to Angie Craig, but does somebody who has just run, traditionally incumbents have a huge edge, but
right.
is it an edge after you've just served one term?
It's a slight edge, but the best time to try to run against an incumbent is that first election when they run re-election, because after that, then it does become dramatically harder and harder and harder to run. And so I think this is her best shot at doing it. Keep in mind also that when she ran last time, I think there's, 11 counties in the second district. I think she won 10 of those counties, losing, was it Scott County? I think it was Scott County I think she lost, and lost pretty big in that one. So she got very close. It wasn't a blowout election that Lewis won on this one, and I think the third party candidate did cost her some votes. I know I had made an argument with a couple other people who saying that third party candidate who was a transgender candidate probably could get about 5% of the vote without hurting Angie Craig, but much beyond that, it would probably come out of her voting constituency, and that person did get 7%. And I do think a couple that 2% right there
probably, that would have flipped it.
That would have flipped it easily. So Angie Craig, you know, has got the resources. She outspent Lewis last time. She's building up the support. This is her best shot of being able to pull it off. And I could envision a scenario, which is kind of interesting here. I could envision a scenario where that seat flips and Tim Walz's seat flips, you know, because...
Well, I think a lot of people are envisioning that scenario possibly.
Exactly. That I think the Democrats are going to have a very, very hard time holding Walz's seat. And I think Craig has, I'm going to say, you know, not quite an even chance. Maybe, let's say, you know, I'm going to say maybe a 45% chance of winning it. Because, again, Lewis is going to have more money this time. He's going to have a better organization. It's going to be a non-presidential election year. So he's got some advantages that he didn't have last time. But it's still not impossible for her to flip it, and the Democrats are coalescing behind her, you know, very rapidly in that race.
Right. And Tim, you know, speaking of barely winning, Tim Walz barely won.
Yes.
Which may be one of the reasons that he is running for governor. All right, let's take a quick break. I want to ask you quickly about Congressman Eric Paulson's district, but also What is going on with the battle between the legislature and the governor? Gone to mediation. That's broken down. It's kind of unclear what's going to happen going forward. So more with David Schultz after this. You're listening to News Radio 830 WCCO. It's 8:50 in the Twin Cities. Do want to give you that final score. There was a lengthy lightning delay in the Gopher-Purdue game. It did not go well for the Gophers, folks. They were down 16-14 right before that rain delay. They end up losing the game 31-17. So, yikes. All right, Esme Murphy along with David Schultz. Let me ask you, we were talking about some of the congressional races, your thoughts about that third congressional district, which the Cook Political Report, which is a very highly regarded report, which has that second district between Angie Craig and Jason Lewis, which we just talked about. They list that as a toss-up. They've got the third leaning Republican. Your thoughts on that?
I still think that's accurate. It's probably still leaning Republican. I mean, we have lots of sort of data and lots of races below the congressional level where the Democrats are very competitive in terms of legislative seats, in terms of city council seats and so forth, and they always keep hoping they're going to be able to do the breakthrough at the congressional level and haven't been able to pull that off. With Eric Paulson in there, you have an incumbent who's now been in there several terms, has a lot of money, a lot of resources, and has done a good job, I think, ingratiating himself with his district. So he'll be hard to beat. I think the problem that he has, and he's been able to sort of, you know, not have to deal with this, is the fact that his voting record is probably as conservative as Tom Emmer's, who matches, you know, the 6th district very well. And for the most part, I would say Paulson has a voting record that probably doesn't align as well with that district as let's say maybe a Jim Ramstead did or previous Republican. And it sets up a possibility that under the right scenario, a Democrat should be able to beat him. But the Democrats have not found the candidate with the resources and with the narrative to do that.
And they do have, I mean, there are a number of candidates running, perhaps the best known philanthropist and businessman, Dean Phillips.
Yes, and he clearly has the resources, and he seems to be a very likable person. I don't know him personally. I don't know if you've had a chance to talk to him.
I have known him for a number of years, and yes, he certainly has the resources, and he is very charismatic, and he's working very hard.
Yes, I was going to say, and the Democrats seem very, very excited by him. And again, you know, whether or not, well, I have to say right now, he's clearly, I'd say, the Democrat front runner in that race, you know, to get the congressional nomination. And he may be one of the stronger candidates the Democrats have had in years. I think where the Democrats squandered an opportunity years ago is when Jim Ramstead stepped down, and it was an open seat, and it's always the best time to win. And the National Democratic Party, and I'd say even locally, didn't put up the resources to try to pick up that seat, because I remember at that time they were still so preoccupied with Michelle Bachmann and wanting to beat her, they seemed to overlook the 3rd district as a much more winnable seat.
But, you know, Terry Bonoff, certainly, who Eric Paulson beat, certainly a major political figure in this state. I mean, very well known, very admired. A lot of people think the campaign wasn't great, but she was somebody who was considered formidable, and that's why you saw all that money coming in.
You did. I was going to say, you certainly had the money. You had the money there. Again, but as a candidate, she turned out to be a fairly flat candidate and didn't really do that very good of a job. And so, and I also perhaps think that she was a victim of again, sort of a Trump, what am I going to call it here, realignment that I think caught her and many Democrats by surprise also. And so she was the candidate I thought that had a pretty good chance of pulling it off. Again, wrong place, wrong time. Now, whether or not in a non-election year or non-presidential election year next year, you know, the Democrats, you know, with a candidate, with this candidate, can actually pull it off, again, is a really interesting question. Because, again, the data still suggests that a Democrat should be very, very competitive in that race.
All right. I want to ask you about what is going on with the governor and the legislature. I mean, where are we? I mean, the mediation broke down. This is over the governor's veto of the funding for the legislature. I mean, what what's the next step, and how do you see this being resolved?
Well, the next step is still unclear, because I think the court was hoping beyond hope that the mediation would extract them from having to resolve this matter themselves. It's now back to the court. The court has to decide what to do in terms of, is it going to order emergency continuing funding? Is it going to actually, in my opinion, decide the case? Because I don't really think it decided the case before. It said that the governor's line item veto was constitutional. It also said that the legislature had a right to exist. And then it also said in the next paragraph that the political process should work this out. What I think the court is hoping for is that somehow there's enough money for all this just to sort of drag out until the next legislative session starts in February of 18. Legislature comes back, overturns the governor's veto, and they can move on from there. That's what I think they're hoping for. But it clearly, I think that it's an unsettled issue, and I think it's setting up for a very acrimonious session next year, of which I think the governor's not going to get very much, if anything, in his last year. And two, I wouldn't be surprised if the legislature comes back and proposes a constitutional amendment that basically prevents future governors from doing what Dayton did to them.
Right. And certainly acrimonious. And you're right, this would be the governor's last legislative session, right?
Correct. And I don't think he has much leverage at this point, because once the legislature comes back into session in February, he has no leverage over them in terms of the reasons why he did the line item veto, because he wanted some changes in policy and tax. They're not going to at all be in a position to want to make any changes. And again, they're going to be in the position, I think, to be able to override, let me not override vetoes, but they're going to clearly be in a position to be able to ignore some things that he wants. But in terms of the funding issue, I think they're going to have enough votes to override the governor's line item veto.
Okay, well, that we will have to see. But certainly, acrimonious, I think that's something we can probably count on.
Yeah, that may be the understated, you know, adjective of the night.
Okay, well, listen, the one and only Professor David Schultz, please check out his blog, Schultz's Take. Thank you so much for your time this evening, as always.
No problem. Good night to all.
Okay, absolutely. David Schultz, folks, the blog, Schultz's Take. I want to give a shout-out to the producer of this show, Susan Blanche, and a big shout-out to Kevin Reed for keeping us on the air and rounding up the guests. Pleasure to be with you on this Saturday night. You are listening to News Radio 830 WCCO.